Some people know me as Walter Volz, but that's not who I am. My real name is Lazarus, and you probably wouldn't recognize me because you don't really socialize too much with people like me. I sit in front of the temple sometimes or the church. My clothes are ragged. They're old, they're torn, they're dirty. I'm not very well. I can't walk very good. And so I have to sit and watch the people go by. You certainly would never want a person like me around your dining room table. I would probably frighten the children when they'd see somebody as decrepit as I. Lazarus. Maybe on a compassionate day I might want to have him come into my house out of the cold, and he could sit under the table where my cats and dogs are fed. You see, Lazarus is real. He represents millions and millions of people on this planet. Many that probably often you've never seen. I've lived a rather long time. I didn't understand some of these dynamics until after I retired. I thought the worst thing that I could do in my life in Vietnam was take bodies to helicopters, not knowing if they're alive or dead. It's horrible, horrible. It's in my memory. But that was wrong. There's something much worse than that. Something much worse than that is finding children by the hundreds on garbage dumps trying to find a piece of bread. On a given day in Guatemala City, over 3,000 people are on that garbage dump. Garbage dumps are about 50 miles long and about 10, 12 miles wide. Thousands of people are on that dump. And that's indicative throughout the world. To wake up in the morning, go down the street on a bicycle, and you have to weave around some that have died the night before. On this planet, there are so many people, I could almost say the majority, do not have a good life. And that's something that often we don't really understand. And why that is not important to me. People say, well, why don't they do this? Why don't they do that? The important question is, where can I find a piece of bread and give it to a child? Where can I find something just to help you now? We're not going to go into political issues, going to rationalization. See, rationalization can say, why aren't they working harder? Why aren't they doing that? That's the way we can dismiss them. It's your fault, not my fault. Tough luck, buddy. Rather than reaching out. So often, Jesus said, do not neglect the poor. So often, Jesus said, remember the poor. When you think of the life of Jesus, he didn't spend an awful lot of time at the temple. And he certainly didn't socialize too much with religious leaders. It's a thought for people like me. And Pastor Paul was to consider sometimes, why is it that Jesus wasn't in the middle of the religious life? Where was he? He was at the temple once in a while. He was lecturing to the scribes and the Pharisees when he was a young man. But he was out with the people. And he was out where he was needed. He was talking to a woman at the well one day. Mary was her name. He said, I know you've been married 7 times. And the man you're living with now is not your husband. But then she was amazed to find out that he didn't condemn her. He said, I haven't condemned you. Go and sin no more. To turn your life around. You're killing yourself. But I love you. Hey, Zacchaeus, come on down from the tree. Let's talk. You're a scammer as a tax collector, aren't you? Go and sin no more. Yeah, I know. Your brother died, Mary and Martha. And I loved him like a brother. But weep no more, for he lives. Jesus was with the people. And our calling is to be with the people of God. To be with those who do not know God, as we know him in the love of Christ. He who came to endure the cross for us. You see, when we read the gospel this morning, Matthew 25, it's an amazing thing to find these words spoken by Jesus when he said, I was hungry, I was naked, I was oppressed. And he identifies himself with those who are hungry in prison because of unjust government. I am among you. I want to tell you a little bit about Food for the Poor, but you, some of you, I'm sure, get many mailings. I get the same mailings you do. But let me tell you about the stole that I'm wearing this morning. It's a story. This has a story unto itself. A little girl was 9 years old. She was found early on in the first year of Food for the Poor. Food for the Poor was started by one man. One man who made a trip to Haiti one day. He was a businessman. He and his family were in the transportation business. And one of their big customers was Publix grocery stores. Publix are big in South Florida, in Florida, Georgia, and South. He discovered people eating out of garbage dumps. It so moved him. He's a Christian man. He came and talked to the executives of Publix, whom he knew very well. He said, you throw a lot of food away, you and Winn-Dixie. Let me have some of that food. There are people I see dying on the streets in Haiti and Jamaica. He said, we can't do it. It's against government regulations. We cannot give any of our food away. It gets very technical. I don't want to go into that. But they sort of in jest said, we can give you a 100-pound bag of rice. Ha, ha, ha. See what you can do with that. Feed the world. Within a few days, he was down in Haiti on the street passing out bowls of rice. One man, 37 years ago. And he began to scrounge food where he could, and other things too then. Last year, Food for the Poor shipped out resources, including food and other things, in the amount of $1 billion, with a B, $1.3 billion. $1 billion. For the last 5 years, it's been over $1 billion, with no great organizational structure. Nobody in business suits having 5-year plans, 10-year plans. A few years ago, I took 7 district presidents and Dr. Kieschnick and mission chairman of the Missouri Synod on a week trip to Guatemala. I do that periodically. I don't know if that was a trip to Guatemala. That may have been to Jamaica. And I remember a couple of said, what kind of clothes do we bring? And I said, well, leave your collars at home. Leave your gowns at home. Make sure you got some good waterproof boots and shorts and mosquito lotions, because we're going to be working from 6 in the morning till 10 at night. You're going to do a lot of walking. You're going to go to the barrio, into the slums, on the garbage dumps. And I still get Christmas cards from some of these. Some have gone to glory, saying that was the greatest event of our life. Explaining even to our church leaders, what's it like to be in destitution, not poverty, destitution. And the mission of Food for the Poor is to reach out to the destitute. The most difficult ones, the ones that very few other organizations will reach out on the garbage dumps and wherever they might be. 9 years old, a little girl was found in a garbage dump in El Salvador. 9 years old, had never spent a day in school with thousands and thousands of other beautiful children who never have the chance to go to school. And the reason for that, sometimes Americans forget the fact, I think we're the only country, or maybe one of the few countries, where children are mandated to be in school. Now, children don't pay to go to school. Sure, we're taxpayers, we pay taxes. But we take education seriously. We want every boy and girl to be in school. In most countries, if you want your kids to go to school, you gotta pay for it. You have to pay the teacher, you have to buy the books, you gotta pay for everything, the uniforms. And most people don't have any money to do that. And that's why so many people, young children, grew up illiterate. 9-year-old girl. Her name was Mary Louise. Louise Marie. Louise, I always get it backwards. It's Louise Marie, which I think it's strange. It wouldn't be Mary Louise, but Louise Marie. And she was one of the first people that we were able to put into school. And that goes back about 35 years ago. We paid our way all the way through grade school, and high school, and college, and medical school. A little 9-year-old girl who had never been to school in life became an eminent doctor, a medical doctor. I was in her home a number of times. I was at her laboratory. Her laboratory was the bottom third of her kitchen table. And she told me so in the experiments, explained them to me. I had a little interest in chemistry. And she was doing a lot of research on how to deal with malnourished children. One of our speakers, one of the district presidents, wasn't feeling so well one day. And it was on that trip. We took him to the hospital in San Salvador. And Louise Marie came into the hospital and started barking orders. She was a very quiet, very gentle lady. In that hospital, she was the king. And I found out she was one of the top doctors in Latin America. Last summer, last June, Louise Marie, I was reading the paper in my backyard, and I saw there was a NATO conference in Belgium, and a world specialist was lecturing on nutrition, and her name was Dr. Louise Marie from El Salvador. I screamed to my wife, I said, you know, I've been in this lady's home a number of times. Did not realize that she's in these circles. That's the story of Food for the Poor. Is it worth it saving one girl? One girl who hadn't been to school until she was 9 years old, one of the world's leading doctors in research trying to help the poor. One day after I left her home, he said, Pastor Volz, I have a gift for you. When I was a girl in high school, I learned to weave and to sew. And I learned the Guatemala system. And this gets complicated a little bit. But see, I made about 3 or 4 of these stoles, and I want to give them to people I meet in life that I think will appreciate them. And she gave me this stole. This little stole, beautifully made, the Guatemalan style, although she was from El Salvador, this is how she learned it. It's a very precious commodity. My children don't want me to carry it with me. But my children don't know I sneak them away all the time. Because I've forgotten it a few times, but I'll make sure I never forget it again. That's the story of Food for the Poor. And I can tell that story 1,000 and 1,000 and 1,000 more times with different people. From that 100-pound bag of rice to over helping people $1.3 billion last year. Our biggest expenditure is helping people with schools, because the bottom rock is education. It's schools. Oh, I see that one's not there. Oh, that's bad, that's bad. That's my timekeeper, see? Now I don't see a timekeeper. The bottom foundation of all that we do has to be education. It is so critical. We support over 900 schools. Now I have to make sure I clarify that. We don't pay the full budget of 900 schools. That would be prohibitive. But we provide schools with many ancillary things, like computers, like laboratories, like food. We provide a lot of them with food. The bedrock of the ministry is getting people to learn to take care of themselves. We are not into welfare. Welfare is one of the worst inventions of humankind. Welfare destroys people's initiative, their desire to excel. We don't give much of anything. We try to give people the ability to learn to take care of themselves. We have built over 200,000 of these little houses, over 200,000 houses. Every house that we provide to people, they have to learn to participate with us to build it. If you're going to get a house, Mama, Grandpa, you have to have a hammer and saw and work with us, so that when that roof starts to leak, you know how to fix it because you helped build it. It's very, very important to give them the tools, to give them the ability to survive, because they have been not had that opportunity in education. Now you think about the bedrock of America. Think about our own society and culture. What's at the foundation? Begins with education. Education. Think of some names of schools that you know of, like Notre Dame, like St. Louis University, like Fordham University, like the Concordia System and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. In fact, we got them all over the country, Portland, Oregon, Portland Christ College in Irvine, California, down south in Austin, Texas, up a few miles up the street, St. Paul, Minnesota, my alma mater, go out in New York and Bronxville. We got them in Seward, we got them in River Forest in Chicago, just within the Missouri Synod. And you can multiply that with other churches, St. Olaf, Southern Methodist in Texas. And you ask the question, why are all these prestigious schools, why do they have Christian names? Because they were started by Christian people. And they were started by people who saw the need and the value of education. In our early history of the Missouri Synod, it is not uncommon many times when the immigrants came from the old countries, they built a school before they built a church. The school was centered in that community. When they had the money, then they built a church. And so it is throughout America. And many Americans don't know that. The same is true with mental and physical health. Years ago, little country doctors, using the abilities they had on horseback, would visit a home. But then there would be times people would come together, all way back to Florence Nightingale, and come into consortiums and groups. And out of that came little clinics and hospitals. Now, name us some hospitals that you know of. Get the same thing, Mayo Clinic. I remember when Dad was pastor here, and he might periodically have to go to the Mayo Clinic, and he'd say to Mom, I'm going to Rochester today. And she would say, take a couple of them with you. So my dad would grab a few, and my brothers and I would spend a little time with our coloring books. In the original building, the big red building, I can still see that red building. It's been torn down now, it's because there's about a five-story high-rise building there now. But I remember as little boys, we toured that campus a lot, probably going to places we were not supposed to be. But in front of that red brick building was a great statue of Jesus Christ. Fred Mayo was the surgeon. And I remember in the corner, first floor of that red building was Dr. Mayo's office. After, next to his office was a chapel. And next to the chapel was an operating room. Fred Mayo used to say, I never go into the operating room without first talking to the great physician in the chapel. That's the basis of the Mayo Clinic. Faith in Jesus Christ, the great healer, for he is the doctor. And so we have hospitals, Lutheran Hospital, Baptist Hospital, Methodist Hospital, Presbyterian, one of the great resource centers in the entire world is in New York, Presbyterian Hospital. You get them all over the country. What are these names? St. John, St. Mary's, Lutheran Hospital. That's our foundation. And that is the second priority that we do, education and health, health for these kids. You can't become healthy eating mud. And you can't become healthy putting mud in your brain either, the way we talk to each other so often. And what becomes so important to us, which is ridiculous so often. So we talk about schools. We talk about mental health, physical health, hospitals, clinics, wherever we go. Every time I take a visit, I'm going to be sure to be in three, four different clinics, different places, and the hospitals, and in the schools, Just a few of the ministries in which we are involved. I could tell you many, many stories, but I think the STOLE is one of the big stories. Tell a little boy, one day I was passing out food, passing out rice. The way that works is we don't have places to come and eat. We have many people that we've trained in third world countries on the computers. Every person that we help has had a home visitation. We look at their situation. And then they are authorized to get X number of servings, maybe two or three times a week, not every day. And they have to bring their own conveyances, their own pails, and they come in and they check in by the thousands, literally the thousands on a feeding day. And then I was passing out rice one day, and a little boy came up and he held up a sign and said five. That means he gets five servings. So I put in five scoops of rice, the next person puts in five pieces of meat, usually it's pork, then five servings of veggies and some bread and some drinks. And then he goes home, or she, and feeds the family. My arm was getting tired one day, and I took a little break, because I'm not used to this motion very much, passing out rice. And the little boy had just filled up his bucket, his whole pail, and he was sitting there waiting for a buddy to come through the line. But he wasn't eating. He had a whole bucket of food. I said, are you hungry? He said, yeah. I said, well, why don't you eat? I'm sitting here watching you. You're not eating any food. He said, I can't. I said, what do you mean you can't? He said, today's not my day to eat. What do you mean? He said, well, the girls eat 4 days a week, and the boys only eat 3 days a week, and today's not my day to eat. Oh, my goodness. Never heard that before then. I went back to the window, and I got another plate. He said, I have a friend out here who needs some food. So the lady relieving me gave me a plate of food, and I went to my buddy, and I said, here. And I can talk to these kids pretty well. I know a little bit about Creole, and I can manage Spanish a little bit, too. All the stuff I learned in seminary, Latin and Greek, doesn't help me that much. But I said to the little boy, he got a plate of food. Here, this is for you. This is not taking food from your sister. This is for you. And he took a little morsel and put the rest in the pail. And I said, why don't you eat it? He said, with a little edge in his voice, I told you, I don't ever cheat on my sisters. I found out how common that is. How these kids look out for each other. It's not give me this, but I'm going to be first in line. I was in a school in El Salvador one day. At lunchtime, I was eating. But when I'm with kids, I never eat. None of us ever eat in the presence of the children. I carry power bars, or I carry stuff, I carry it along, and I give it all away. I give away pens. Whatever I got in my buddy, I give to the kids. But I was sitting with them about my box lunch. It was chicken. And the boy next to me is about a fifth grader. And he was looking at my box that was full. And I said, do you want that drumstick? He said, yeah, if we're not going to eat it. I said, oh, you can have it. And he put it in his lunch bill. I said, what are you going to do with that? He said, I'm going to take it home for my grandma. A little girl across the table saw what was happening, and she was looking. I said, you want that wing? I said, yeah. She put it in her lunch bill. I said, what are you going to do with it? Give it to my baby brother. I see that all the time. They take care of each other. Nobody supersedes anybody else. God's grace is so abundant among the poor. How they care for each other. In the bulletin this morning, you have a little brochure. If you look at that picture, the front, here's a picture of sadness. Look at that picture. You look at those eyes. You can look right through her eyes, shallowness. It's not happy. It's not really sad. It's neutral. And so many kids are this way. They have been hurt. They're afraid of being hurt because they're just kids that are shunted around to the side. I like to see kids full of energy and exuberance. It never bothered me as a pastor if kids start crying in church. I'm glad they're there. After about a minute or so, mom take them back out and calm them down a little bit. But they should be in church. And if they cry, they're kids. And I'd rather see a child exuberant than a child that's all passivity. That's this little girl. And they are so afraid. They are always afraid. Now, I can't go into details of this. Part of that fear comes from the voodoo theology and the Zulu theology. Voodooism, particularly from the Caribbean. We're seeing it more and more in South Florida, in America. And voodooism has all to do with evil spirits and devils who are out to hurt you because you somehow are an affront to the devils. They're always fighting. That's voodooism. And it is so saddening for us when I want to talk to somebody and they will run to the voodoo priest. And the voodoo priest will have them do incantations and take what little money they have. And it's very difficult sometimes to establish that trust relationship. And they say, I'm not going to hurt you. I want to show you what it means to love somebody. They've never had those experiences. Even to reach out to touch a little boy or a little girl, they're afraid. Until they begin to trust you. And one of the greatest joys of my life is coming in a van to a community, and there are 10, 20, 30, 50 kids running to the bus. And I have so many kids that I've learned to establish rapport with. One of the things they will say is, tell me a story of Jesus. They love the parables. I go through the arch books. If you're familiar with the arch books, they love to tell stories and to hear the stories. When you think about how did Jesus teach, he didn't teach basically cognitively. He told stories. We call them parables. You tell stories. You make up the stories of their life, You know, you go fishing and you got a boat, you got an oar, and it makes it move. There's something else that can make you move. And you, whatever it is, talk about palm trees, make up a story. And they love to hear the stories. And that's so often how you break that barrier of fear and distrust. If you open this up here, it tells you a few things that we do. I can't go into all the things that we do. It would take for 3-4 hours. But at the end of this little brochure, as you open it up, it makes a little envelope. Now, I know you're a little jarred. If you could leave a gift for us this morning for food for the poor, that would be a wonderful blessing. You could use this little envelope, or you can use those jars, but you can't put those envelopes in those jars. So you might want to consider using these little envelopes and give them to me at the end of the service. Don't put them in the offering plate. I like to have people interact. If you can give me a gift, that's wonderful. If you can't, you can do one thing, and that can ensure us you can give us your prayers. Because we live on prayer. We don't live on structure and bureaucracy and organization. We live on prayers in the heart of God's people. At the end of the service, we can have a prayer one for another. God comes to us in prayer. There was a great missionary in India. His name was P.T. Niles, great missionary. And somebody asked him, Dr. Niles, tell me, in a nutshell if you can, what does it mean to be a Christian witness? He said, I'll tell you very simply. It doesn't have much to do with church membership. To be a witness for Jesus Christ is no more and no less than one poor beggar showing another poor beggar where to find a piece of bread. Welcome, my good friends. We're all beggars before God. You know, I stand before the Lord imminently, whenever that may be. I can't say, you know, God, aren't you glad to see me? I started 8 new churches in your name, and I preached around the world. And his answer to me will be, depart from me. I don't know who you are. It's not what I've done. I might say, well, Lord, I've done all these things. Depart from me. You may say, I was state chairman of the LWML. I was president of my congregation. I was on the board of a, I don't know who you are. Depart from me. And then one stands up. Says, wait a minute, Father, wait a minute. I know that man. I know that woman. I've known them because you and I, we gave them their name in the water of baptism. That's one of the most precious objects you have in the church. For me, that's where that Christian life began, with my brothers and sisters, the waters of baptism. It's a treasure. Not the work of art. It's what it has done over the years. You know that man, says the Father. You know that one, yes. The doors are wide open. Why are those doors wide open? It's because of what Jesus Christ has done. It's because of the love of God in Jesus Christ. And that's the message we want to communicate to the children, as young as we can, 2 and 3 and 4 years old. Because the first 12 years of a child's life will form, basically, that child's future. It's those first 12 years. I like to say, so important to the caregivers of our soul. I have great admiration for my father. He was a scholar. He was a theologian. He taught at the seminary in the summer times, large parish in St. Paul. But all the theology I have ever learned, and I've got a whole bunch of degrees, everything that I've learned to sustain me in life, I learned from my mother. It's my mother who was my teacher. She's the one who taught me to fold my hands in prayer. She's the one that would say to me, Walter, before you go to bed, you better apologize to your sister. That was not nice what you said at supper time. It's those years of a mother, sometimes wiping away the tears, and sometimes as a mother being bold in confronting behaviors. Yes, it is the women of the homes. It is the women of the homes that are the great teachers of theology. And that's the first 12 years of life. So critical and so important. And it's such a great blessing for us to have the opportunity, in America particularly, to give credit to mothers, whenever it's Mother's Day or any day, as well as the fathers, because it's a team effort. It's not men doing the important stuff and women following. It's we all do what is so critically important in guiding our children, in guiding the children, those early years of life. The church has known that for centuries, and that's why it is so critical. I'm so grateful for the parochial schools that we still have in our synod, where children begin the day in prayer and they end the day in prayer. For our life is that of prayer. One beggar showing another beggar where to find a piece of bread. If you could give an envelope to me at the end, that's wonderful. If you can't, keep us in prayer, because we live in prayer. And I know you have many options. We work together with many of them. We don't work together, by the way, with Food for the Poor alone. We work with Habitat. We work with all kinds of ministries. Particularly right now, we're doing work in Puerto Rico. We're doing work in the islands. We're doing work in the Bahamas. It's not one of our countries, but we go and we do that work. We have big teams in Bahamas right now. Thank you, Pastor, for letting me share this message. Sometimes I get a little longer because I love the kids and I love the Lord, that He would bless them as I saw these little children this morning. God's peace be with you. Amen.
Amen. And thank you for blessing us with that message.